That was an episode of Wings, a feminist Canadian broadcasting service, and I thank them very much for letting us borrow that episode. You've been listening to In the Motherhood here on CKUT 90.3 FM, and it's almost 7 p.m. here in Montreal. If you'd like to know more about In the Motherhood and what we mentioned on the show today, including Tara Schwartz's book, Can't Help Falling, A Long Road to Motherhood, you can go to CKUT-InTheMotherhood on Facebook, and you can email us at inthemotherhood@ckut.ca. Thanks for listening and stay tuned for more.
Good evening and welcome to Amanla, 1 hour of African current affairs brought to you here on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal. I'm sitting here virtually with my sidekick, Doug, and we have a nice little show put together for you today. Doug, what do you have lined up?
Well, I've been looking through the amazing amount of material that's starting to come out on podcasts and webinars about Africa. And amongst other things, I came across a series called African Biographics from South Africa. Very interesting. They describe themselves as a channel where we profile African personalities that have made or are making a lasting impact on world scene. They upload regularly. In fact, I was quite amazed in the last year how much they have put together. And these are sort of very basic. And the politics is somewhat, I don't know if it's all that I like, but it's still nonetheless very informative. I've chosen one tonight called the Untold Story of Namibia's Struggle Against Apartheid South Africa, really the story of Sam Nujoma, the president. But they've done other articles as well, Steve Biko, Amilcar Cabral, and then people like Fela Kuti and Jonas Savimbi and the mercenary Mad Mike Hoare. So it's an interesting series, and that's what I will cover tonight with the story of Namibia.
Okay, great. And I had an opportunity to talk with Andy Currier yesterday. He's a research associate at the Oakland Institute, and they are one of the organizations that's really our go-to when it comes to anything around land grabbing, land dispossession. And so Andy and I had a really interesting conversation about a very disturbing phenomenon, which is the role of conservation agencies, international conservation agencies like UNESCO, for example, that have become the driving force in driving Indigenous people off of their land in order to create game parks for tourism. So it's a bit of a sickening triangle. It's going on in a very aggressive fashion in Tanzania right now, with the Maasai being the primary victims of this. The Maasai are pushing back. There was a really nasty, violent episode in June. So Andy brings us up to date with what happened in June, and then we talk more broadly about this phenomenon. So stay tuned to Amanla.
Somebody, when you see that.
Tanzania is in the grips of a struggle, one that pits indigenous peoples against the powerful twin forces of conservation and tourism backed by the Tanzanian state. This struggle has ramped up over the last few months to deadly effect. Andy Currier is a research associate at the Oakland Institute in Oakland, California. Hi, Andy. Welcome back to Amandla.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So you've been on the show previously talking about the role of conservation agencies in displacing indigenous people in Tanzania to make way for conservation areas and tourism. In June, there was a violent episode in Loliondo that seems to have upped the ante. So could you start just by telling us about the specifics of what happened there?
Yeah, so the Loliondo division, now it's just crucial. Last time I was on, I was talking about the Gorongoro Conservation Area World Heritage Site, and that's actually located to the south of Loliondo. So where this recent violence was is outside of the World Heritage Site. But yeah, as you mentioned, this summer has seen a real escalation in violence by the government towards the Maasai. So you had this area of land, it was known as a game-controlled area. So this is a classification that allowed human settlement and livestock grazing, in addition to conservation and tourism and some hunting. Now, since January, the government has taken steps to convert this, it's a 1,500 square kilometer area of land, into a game reserve. Now, this is a move that would force the removal of over 70,000 Maasai pastoralists from their land to be used exclusively for trophy hunting and tourism by the United Arab Emirates-based Otterlo Business Company. So what happened was they went to demarcate this land with a very heavy police presence, and the Maasai actually gathered en masse knowing the stakes here and began to take some of the beacons down. The police responded by opening fire, so injuring dozens of Maasai. Thousands remain displaced in Kenya today, and they continue to suffer from hunger and face high medical costs. And because this land has been demarcated and is now known as a game reserve, there are a very high number of people, some estimates put it at 70,000, who have lost access to their dry season grazing land, which is really crucial to the health of their livestock and, of course, their livelihoods.
Okay, well, maybe let's talk a little bit about their livelihoods, because I'm not sure all of our listeners really know what a pastoralist way of life is. So maybe if you could describe for us what that is.
Yeah, so, you know, for centuries, the Maasai have been the stewards of this land in East Africa and in Tanzania. So they've got a really finely honed symbiotic relationship with the environment. And this allows their cattle to survive. So cattle are very, very important for Maasai livelihoods. They rely on cattle for, cultural reasons, but also, of course, for nutrition, for milk. So they graze their cattle sustainably in a way that actually over time has been perfected to help livestock and wild animals and the local environment actually all thrive together. So this is what Maasai have been doing, for centuries. And it's why the area today is so so coveted for tourism and for people to go on safari, because of the stewardship of the Maasai.
And I guess the biodiversity that they've been able to maintain in that area. Right. Do they do any cultivation at all, or is it all...
So they used to be allowed to cultivate, and in times of, in dry years, they would set up small home gardens. That's actually one of the more devastating restrictions that's been imposed on them in recent years by the government. So limiting home subsistence gardens, which has, been a big player in a hunger crisis that Maasai have been facing for a number of years now.
Why would the government be limiting something like that?
It's a good question. And, the rationale for it hasn't really been made clear. I think some of the drivers could be that tourists to the area don't want to see farms. They're in an area they want to pretend is wild, and that there are just, lions and elephants and zebras there and no farms at all. So I think that could be part of it. But yeah, it's been really devastating for Maasai not being able to cultivate their own subsistence gardens.
And I gather as part of this violence, a fair amount of their livestock was confiscated. And
yeah, so livestock have been being confiscated. So land that used to be okay for them to graze in, Masai will take their land there. The wildlife or livestock agencies will seize the cattle, tell them they're on illegal land, and then make them pay these exorbitant rates to get them back. So in some cases, Masai can't afford to get them back. In other cases, you know, if they wait a while, they try to put money together to get them back. You know, the cattle health suffers, their own health suffers without, you know, access to some of the milk and other products they get from cows. So it's been a really, you know, effective way the government has been hurting the Maasai by seizing livestock.
Now, where do things stand right now?
Right now, so there remains, I think it's, you know, tens of thousands of Maasai from Loliondo remain in Kenya. So a lot of them fled to Kenya during this violence. There's lots of videos of this on social media and on various websites of, you know, what really looks like a large-scale military action. You hear, you know, gunfire in the background. You see Maasai running for their lives, frankly. And so a lot of them remain in Kenya. This includes high number of women and children. And then so they're receiving some medical care. There are Maasai, you know, right on the Kenyan-Tanzanian border in Kenya who have been trying to help as much as they can. There's been some aid given by different organizations, but a lot of them remain there and, you know, afraid to go back to Loliondo given, you know, how the government has treated them.
And also, I think that this is not the first time that people in that area have been through this. I think in 2017, there was quite an onslaught against that community. Can you tell us just a little bit about what happened then?
Yeah, there was. And it was, you know, it really looks like very similarly motivated to clear this land for the exclusive use of the Otterlo Business Company. And so at that time, there were bomas that were burned, you know, people arrested en masse. And you actually had in response several Maasai villagers take the Tanzanian government to the East African Court of Justice. Now their case, you know, they had a small victory. I think it was a few years after that. I can't remember the specific years. It might be 2019, where the East African Court granted an injunction telling the government to stop, you know, harassing the Maasai, to stop, you know, removing them from their land. And that injunction, you know, really seems to have been violated by this most recent conflict.
Okay, so now let's kind of broaden it out a little bit to talk about conservation, because I think that the whole phenomenon of using conservation laws to dispossess indigenous inhabitants of their land and other resources is something, well, that dates back to the colonial period. But I think that for a lot of people, probably some of our listeners included, it would come as a bit of a surprise that conservation agencies like UNESCO, the International Union for the Conservation of Nature, and the International Council on Monuments and Sites have been major driving forces in moving the Maasai off their ancestral lands in order to create these conservation areas or game reserves. So, I mean, really, I think most people in their imaginations think of conservation agencies as positive and critical, especially in this time of climate crisis. So, Andy, can you help us to understand this a little bit? Why are conservation agencies involved in this?
Yeah, and you know, I think important first note is that while these conservation agencies, the UNESCO World Heritage Center, might have generally positive connotations in, you know, the US or Canada, for these Maasai communities, this is, you know, organizations that have consistently been kind of pushing for policies that don't have their best interests in mind and frankly don't take their you know, opinions and recommendations into consideration. So this dates back a long time, as you mentioned. So there were, you know, over the past century, there's been numerous laws first passed by the British colonial government and then the Tanzanian government, and often with the support and kind of guidance of international conservation groups, forcing the Maasai onto smaller and smaller plots of land. So initially, to get Maasai to leave the Serengeti National Park, they promised them this area, which would be the Ngorongoro Conservation Area, which would allow them to live there, and kind of it'd be a multiple land use, so they'd be balancing, you know, their livelihoods with the environment. But back, I think it was in 1959, even, it was said that if there's any conflict in the needs of the Maasai versus the needs of wildlife or the environment, then the needs of the Maasai would come first in this newly created Gorongoro conservation area. That just has not been the case. So more recently, why the World Heritage Center has been implicated in this, there was this joint monitoring mission report back in March of 2019. So that was UNESCO, IUCN, and ECOMOS, where they visited the NCA and they put out a list of recommendations calling for the government to urgently control population growth, given the impact that it was having on the land. So the Tanzanian government took this list of recommendations and has been advancing a radical resettlement plan that would remove the majority of Maasai pastoralists from the area.
Let's talk about this population thing for a second, because I know that the Oakland Institute has taken a critical look at this notion that the problem here is overpopulation and it's going to erode the area and threaten the animals and the biodiversity. And you take this head on. So explain to us what's going on.
Yeah, so population is of Maasai is one of the big myths being pushed by conservation agencies and the government to justify the removal of the Maasai. And frankly, it's difficult to get the exact number of Maasai pastoralists living within the Gorongoro Conservation Area. And there have been some migrants there recently, but given all of the restrictions in place there, it's not somewhere that people necessarily want to flock and live. It's not desirable. If you're restricted on home gardens, that's not very advantageous. There are some people who live there and work in the tourism industry, but in general, the Maasai do support the removal of some or the relocation of some recent migrants to the area. However, the way the government is doing this is very top down and not allowing actual Maasai communities to control the process and help get it so it could actually work out. It's really just being top down and trying to get them out of there. So what we found in our research, and it was really looking at a lot of studies that have been done, is the Maasai, their practices, their symbiotic relationship with the environment actually helps the ecology of the area. So one example that I found really interesting was the use of fire. So Maasai would burn grasses periodically, and that would help reduce invasive species and some really bad ticks and pests and stuff that damage wildlife. And since Maasai have been barred from grazing cattle in certain areas and can't go there, can't practice their traditional land management practices, you've seen a huge explosion of invasive species. So something like that being blamed for Maasai population completely ignores how, the livelihood restrictions are also damaging the environment.
The government insists that really what this is about, it's a voluntary resettlement program. They don't use the term eviction. They say that, we're offering people alternatives, land and resources and, various infrastructure and all of that, and that people are volunteering to do this. Is there any truth to that claim?
There have been a handful of volunteers, but I think it's that term volunteer is pretty loaded when there are all of these restrictions on livelihoods in the area. There are some people, there's been cuts to schools and hospitals that were supposed to be built with COVID relief funds in the NCA, and the government has transferred that out to another area. So there are some people who are fed up with not being provided any services and just basically being left to starve. And so they volunteered to leave, but what's happened is the government is really overpromising what these relocation sites look like. So we had a report come out earlier this summer that was based on field research to some of these relocation sites. And what we found were huge discrepancies between what the government was promising and the reality. So the area, it's the Samara village, and Handini is one of the main ones where the government's built about 300 houses so far. They're saying there's plenty of water and there's plenty of grazing land. Maasai can bring their cattle. What we've already seen is that this is an area that suffers from drought. There have not been, water investments have not materialized and grazing land is reduced. So Maasai are only allowed to bring a very small number of livestock, which really you need a certain number to have a pastoralist livelihood be sustainable. And then, really importantly, because the government is in a lot of the media in Tanzania is just parroting the government talking points. While there are some people who have done this, there's thousands of Maasai who signed letters saying they do not want to be relocated. They want to be given, control over land use in their ancestral land rather than sent to another area, thousands of kilometers away.
Okay, I'm going to push a little bit on the whole again, this phenomenon of conservation organizations being one of the driving forces in dispossessing Indigenous people. So, you know, what do you think that's all about? I mean, are they just ignorant and naive and just think that, you know, really the best way to protect all of those beautiful wild animals in East Africa is to vacate people from the area? Like, is that fundamentally how they're thinking about this?
You know, it's hard for me to get inside their heads, but I think we've seen enough examples of, you know, some of their words being very different from their actions. So in the recommendation of that joint monitoring mission, there's the UNESCO Tanzania National Commission, which is separate, I guess, from the overarching UNESCO committee. It's unclear how exactly disconnected it is, but they actually called for the more extreme version where they wanted all people removed from the NCA, but to retain bomas, which are their, you know, traditional kind of housing structures for cultural tourism. So it shows that they're, you know, they're preserving culture in a way that, you know, is being done at the same time as removing the actual people who have, you know, who are responsible for that culture. So it doesn't make very much sense. And you just see again, with while they do recognize some of the impacts of tourism on the environment, when they're very scientific kind of ecology-based studies, they don't recommend that, you know, the number of tourists is limited, the number of SUVs is limited. They're really pushing more on the Maasai, which does not make any sense.
Yeah. I guess, I mean, you live in the United States, I live in Canada, we're talking about Tanzania. We know that our national parks here were once Indigenous land and that very similar processes, or it was a similar phenomenon in the sense that people were dispossessed of their land to create the parks that we so love to hike through and camp in. And certainly when our parks were created in that fashion, it was very much driven by a racist ideology. Do you think that there's a kind of an undercurrent of racism in how these lands are being, how this issue is being approached by these organizations?
Yeah, I think it's a very kind of colonial Western top-down mindset of we are the experts and we know best, and thinking about how ridiculous it would be if, you know, if a country in Africa or Asia sent experts to tell Americans how to conserve Yosemite. You know, it's the same thing, that it just doesn't make any sense. And it is this kind of the West knows best, the developed countries have the answers to everything, despite, as you mentioned, the horrible history in our own national parks. And I think that's something that isn't as widely understood in our own histories, and just seeing how, you know, the reason so many of these places are worth preserving today is because of the stewardship of Indigenous groups. So taking them away from management is going to be disastrous long term. And you know, there are some really good studies that show that Indigenous people are the best, you know, stewards of nature, and there's lots of evidence to back this up. So while you'll see some conservation agencies, and after some of this violence, there were some statements saying that, you know, they don't support any of the violence, and they don't you know, want to see any forceful evictions. You know, what they're doing behind the scenes is completely detached from those statements that sound good.
Earlier in the interview, you talked about how there have been some successful, that the Maasai have launched some successful legal challenges to what has happened. Can you tell us a little bit more about the tactics that are being used to resist this change and try to find a different way forward?
Yeah, so because the Tanzanian government under its current president and president before really disregarded the rights of the Maasai and consistently trampled on their rights to land and life, they took their case to the East African Court of Justice. And this is something that's been very slow moving. And actually a decision was expected very recently, and it was just pushed back to September, a few months down the road. So it's kind of frustrating because it doesn't seem to be in line quickly enough to protect the Maasai. I mean, they are facing, you know, as I mentioned, there are thousands who remain displaced right now in Kenya, afraid to come back. There are others who can't access land necessary for their livelihoods. So the legal strategy, while could potentially offer something down the road, has been, you know, something that hasn't been quick enough to protect them in the short term.
And what about the court of popular opinion? You did talk about how, I guess, a lot of the media in Tanzania are parroting the government line, but is there any public support in Tanzania or even regionally in East Africa for the Maasai struggle?
Yeah, there has been. And despite, you know, the as I mentioned, the media in Tanzania has really been pushing back, really talking about how the area is being devastated by Maasai overpopulation, and to protect it, they need to be removed, and all these myths being pushed. There are people who know the situation, and there's a lot of good voices on Tanzanian social media who are really courageously speaking out, given that, you know, people are being arrested for speaking out against the government about this. And despite that fact, there have been many Maasai activists and other major figures who have taken it upon themselves to make this a big issue. Internationally, there's been a ton of coverage, especially after the violence, major headlines in almost every big newspaper, letter from the UN special rapporteurs, quite a bit of pressure. And then despite that, we have seen the government just not be moved by that. So it's been concerning that they haven't been moved by it. The one hopeful route is that donor countries to Tanzania haven't threatened to remove any funds. And that's something that I think could get the Tanzanian government into acting down the road if they had, you know, funds withheld over this. But for that to take place, I think donor countries would need to really look at it for themselves and not just trust the Tanzanian government for its work.
Before we wrap up, I guess there's, you know, there's the big T word in all of this, which is tourism, which we've touched on a little bit, but we haven't really talked about. It's a fantastically wealthy industry with a lot of clout. You know, we've talked about the conservation organizations that seem to be paving the way for an increase in tourism, but is the industry itself, is there any evidence that they have a hand in what's going on here directly?
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely seen as a motivating factor for the Tanzanian government. I mean, with all this bad press, with all this international condemnation, why they continue to move forward with this when what Maasai are asking for is incredibly reasonable. They just want to be, you know, given authority over the land use. And they're okay with, you know, a lot of cases, some tourism, but the fact that the whole area is being turned into solely a moneymaker on tourism is what's really concerning. And, you know, the number of tourists within the NCA has really skyrocketed recently. So with COVID, obviously there was a disruption, but it went from 45,000 people to 73,000 people into the Gorongoro crater, an increase of 63% between 2014 and 2018. So wow. A really, really short period. You just see the number skyrocket. The number of those big SUVs into the crater was at 350 per day. So any talk of what's being done is for conservation's sake is just ignoring how much money is being generated here. And unfortunately, you see the Tanzanian government have projections for wanting to make even more money off of tourism into the future. So that really does seem to be, you know, guiding what they're doing. And seeing, you know, there's lots of luxury hotels in the area, and Maasai being, you know, not allowed to build modern schools or hospitals, but it's okay for there to be a luxury hotel, kind of shows the hypocrisy here.
Absolutely. So for people who want to know more, I know that one of your key reports is the looming threat of eviction, the continued displacement of the Maasai under the guise of conservation in the Ngorongoro Conservation Area. Do you have any other suggestions of how people can get educated, if they want to take action, what they could possibly do?
Yeah, it's a great question. And so I think, first off, at the Oakland Institute website, we've got a number of publications on this. If you search by Tanzania, you'll see it all, the reports, the press releases. We've been really keeping up on the latest updates of the press releases at least every month. So you can also subscribe to our reporter newsletter that'll send updates right to your inbox. We also launched a petition alongside Rainforest Rescue, has over 133,000 signatures, and that contains a list of Maasai community demands to the government and to the international conservation agencies. So definitely recommend people sign that. There's a couple other petitions as well. There's, I think, you know, another thing, if someone's in a position to travel right now and wants to go on a safari, I know it's not something that's attainable for everybody, but if you're considering doing that, I would not recommend going to Tanzania right now until the situation is addressed.
Yeah. Hey, any talk of an organized tourism boycott around this issue?
You know, it's I think it's being discussed in some circles. It's definitely a difficult thing to do because they're just, again, it's the bottom line. It's a profit motivated business, unfortunately, and there are far fewer outlets. You know, there might be some good tourism groups or some good safari ones, but the number that just care about that bottom line and their profits is unfortunately the majority.
Okay, Andy, thank you so much for joining us again. It's been very, very helpful, and I'm sure we will continue this conversation down the road.
Yeah, always happy to come back, and thanks again for having me.
Thanks.
You're listening to Amandla Radio. I'm Doug Miller here with Gwen Schulman, and this is on CQUT 90.3 FM Montreal. I'm going to now play a piece I found under African Biographics, The Untold Story of Namibia's Struggle Against Apartheid South Africa, really the story about their liberation leader, Sam Nujoma. I heartily encourage you to look up the African Biographics series. It's very well done. Stay tuned to that piece on Namibia.
Ladies and gentlemen, this song is called The Wind of Change Sweeping Across the African Continent. The wind of change sweeping across the African continent. The wind of change, oh, sweeping across the African continent. Over there, they say this. Oh, yeah, Africa. Oh, yeah, ooh. Amandla. Oh, we do. Aluta, continue, mama, we are. Viva Africa. Yeah, the wind of change. The wind of change. The wind of change. Oh, yeah. The wind of change. Oh, yeah. The wind of hope sweeping across the African continent, the wind of hope sweeping across the African continent. Over there, they say this. Oh yeah, Africa. Oh yeah, Uhuru mama. Oh, where to? Aluta, la continua mama. Where? Viva Africa. Yeah, the wind of hope. Oh yeah, the wind of hope. The wind of hope, oh yeah. The wind of hope. The wind of freedom sweeping across Mama Africa. The wind of freedom sweeping across Mother Africa. Over there, they say this. Oh yeah, Africa. Oh yeah, Uhuru. Amandla, oh wetu. Aluta, la continua mama wea. Viva Africa. Yeah, the wind of freedom. Oh yeah, the wind of freedom. Please, somebody.
Namibia's bitter 100-year struggle against colonial rule came to an end on 21 March 1990. When Sam Nujoma was sworn in as the first president of independent Namibia. As the co-founder and leader of the Southwest Africa's People's Organization, SWAPO, Sam Nujoma spearheaded the country's 30-year military and diplomatic campaign attacking South Africa's illegal presence in what was at the time called Southwest Africa. In the process, Sam Nujoma emerged as the personification of the Namibian independence struggle. It took many years of revolt and warfare for Namibia to gain its independence from South Africa, and during the years of revolt and warfare, between 20,000 and 25,000 people died. In this episode of African Biographics, we cover the story of Sam Nujoma, Namibia's first president, and how that country eventually achieved independence from South Africa. Namibia, which was called German Southwest Africa and then simply Southwest Africa, had been colonized by Imperial Germany during the scramble for Africa. Following the end of the First World War and under the terms of the Treaty of Versailles, Germany surrendered its colonies to the Allies, and in December of 1920, German Southwest Africa was entrusted to South Africa to administer on behalf of the newly formed League of Nations. South Africa was expected to have full administration and legislative control over the territory until the people of the country were ready to take this responsibility upon themselves. What then transpired was that South Africa administered the territory in the same way the main imperial powers, Britain and France, had treated their African colonies. After the Second World War, the League of Nations was transformed into the United Nations, but South Africa refused to place Southwest Africa under the United Nations or to recognize that the United Nations had jurisdiction on the territory. 1948 saw the National Party in South Africa successfully grab power, and saw the same apartheid laws that this regime effected in South Africa were also introduced in Southwest Africa. These laws prevented black Namibians from having any political rights, as well as restricted social and economic freedoms. In 1949, South Africa virtually incorporated Southwest Africa into the Union of South Africa as a fifth province, and the South African government simply stopped providing the United Nations with annual reports of its administration of the territory. This move was tantamount to annexation. Economic integration of Southwest Africa soon followed, and most of the country's wealth, which was derived from its vast mineral resources, was diverted to South Africa. It was these mineral resources that encouraged and motivated South Africa to try and hold on to the territory throughout the many years of revolution. Inevitably, Namibians, who had a long history of resisting colonialism, finally rebelled. On 10 December 1959, mass protests against apartheid were held in the capital, Windhoek. This is because, in this instance, South Africa's officials tried to relocate the black population from the center of Windhoek into the township of Katutura, and so public discontent grew, spawning an open protest. During this demonstration, police opened fire on protesters. Several people were injured and some were tragically killed. This event signaled a major growth of nationalist opposition in Southwest Africa. Prior to this event, the Ovamboland People's Congress had been formed in 1957 in Africa by Namibians working in South Africa. This organization was under the leadership of Andimba Toivo Yatoivo. The OPC hoped to abolish the South African pass system, which required black laborers to seek official permission before moving from one job to another. The system also forced them to accept lower wages and lower level jobs than their white Southwest African counterparts.
Colonialism was terrible here in Namibia. African children were taught that they have half a brain to those of the whites. And apartheid here.
In 1959, Toivo ya Toivo persuaded Sam Nujoma to extend the activities of the OPC to Windhoek, Southwest Africa, by starting the Ovamboland People's Organization. This was the same year that the black people in Windhoek had been ordered to move from the old location that had housed them for generations to Katutura, the place where no one lives. Let me give you a brief background on Sam Nujoma. The man known as Samuel Shafishuna Daniel Nujoma was born on the 12th of May 1929 in the Okanjera district of Ovamboland in northern Southwest Africa. During this time, as was the case in South Africa itself, the compulsory education enjoyed by both rural and urban white children was denied to black students. In 1943, Sam Nujoma moved to Walvis Bay, the coastal city, to live with an aunt, and a few years later, in 1949, Nujoma moved to the country's capital, Windhoek. Here, Nujoma attended night classes at St. Barnabas Anglican Mission, and so he was able to achieve an 8th grade education. This was all while working for the South African Railways during the day. Nujoma's daily activities at South African Railways consisted almost entirely of sweeping floors and making tea. Although this work offered him little intellectual stimulation, His position gave him the chance to become a labor union organizer. One notable event in his career as an organizer came after a fellow worker was sent home without compensation following a serious injury. So Nuyoma tried to form a trade union for the railway men to stop such things from occurring, but his political activities cost him his job in 1957, but not before he built a useful network of friends with similar interests. That's how he connected to activists like Andimba Toivo Yatoivo, the founder of the Ovamboland People's Congress. When Sam Nuyoma joined politics, the Ovamboland People's Organization that he had formed in Windhoek in conjunction with Toivo Yatoivo quickly swelled, attracting so many non-Ovambo members. This indicated that the movement had now transcended the tribal lines, and so the organization's name was changed to the Southwest African People's Organization, SWAPO. SWAPO's aim was to fight colonial rule and to abolish the policies of separate development and separate education for blacks and whites. At the meeting held at Old Location, Sam Nuyoma was accompanied by a chanting crowd of supporters. This meeting was where he first proposed Southwest Africa's independence to white government officials. Unsurprisingly, his suggestion angered the government and brought with it incessant attention from the police, who began to follow Nuyoma's every move. Sam Nuyoma was subsequently arrested for his role in organizing the resistance. As the situation for him in Southwest Africa had become somewhat dangerous, Nuyoma and other SWAPO members went into exile. From exile, they commenced an energetic campaign to thrust the plight of the Namibian people into the international spotlight. In 1961, Sam Nuyoma established SWAPO headquarters in Dar es Salaam, Tanzania. Nuyoma then spent the next 5 years on a diplomatic offensive, traveling throughout Africa and Europe in search of support for his organization and the Namibian struggle for independence. This was at the time where numerous nationalist movements were preparing for armed struggle against white minority regimes across southern Africa. But Nuyoma initially undertook a different approach to achieving Namibian liberation. And so he orchestrated a campaign of international diplomacy directed at triggering the United Nations to enter into the Namibian political process. Unfortunately, this yielded little to no results for him and SWAPO aside from statements of sympathy and solidarity. As a result, Nuyoma and SWAPO decided that the only way to achieve independence was to turn to the armed struggle. Sam Nuyoma and SWAPO formed a military wing called the People's Liberation Army of Namibia, PLAN, and the first battle between PLAN and South African forces took place in August of 1966. During this first clash, a small group of poorly armed PLAN soldiers fought against military helicopters and professional soldiers of South Africa, so the odds were heavily against them. Apart from heavy casualty on PLAN's side, this action was followed by the accelerated approval of the Terrorist Act in Southwest Africa. This law was then used during a trial against 35 SWAPO members who had been arrested shortly after the first fight. Those convicts were imprisoned in the infamous Robben Island prison where Nelson Mandela spent many years. But it was not all doom and gloom for Nuyoma and SWAPO. What this conflict did was that it brought the attention of the international community to SWAPO and the armed struggle. PLAN had its arms supplied by the Soviet Union and other Eastern Bloc countries, and the forces conducted localized and sporadic attacks against South African interests in Southwest Africa. It's worth mentioning that during the 1960s, Angola, Namibia's other neighbor, was still a Portuguese colony. What that meant was that any supply lines to friendly neighbors were too long for the PLAN forces to get enough weapons and aid to start a serious military campaign. It was a logistical nightmare for PLAN's forces to mobilize in an effective manner. However, this did not deter PLAN. As they were faced with the logistical problems, Nuyoma and the SWAPO leadership moved their center of operations twice, eventually setting up base in Zambia. But all was not well in SWAPO. A few cracks started emerging. SWAPO started having internal squabbles and altercations, which did little to help in the struggle for independence. This is because Nuyoma and the leadership in exile developed a political culture that discouraged debate and criticism. Anyone who dared voice their opposing opinion was labeled as disloyal. This restrictive political climate aimed to silence criticisms of the leadership. Sam Nyoma proved well adept at silencing dissent within the movement. When SWAPO members demanded more democratic procedures, a clear indication that he and SWAPO's top brass were moving towards authoritarianism occurred in the mid-1970s when idealistic radicals of the SWAPO Youth League revolted against the top SWAPO leadership, which was now operating from exile in Zambia. Nyoma crashed the challenge to his authority by invoking Zambian military assistance to arrest and detain the dissidents. Thereafter, strict hierarchy and party discipline were established. Another dark chapter in SWAPO's history came in the form of atrocities committed by its members in its detention camps in Angola, notably in Lubango. So those suspected of subversive behavior were arrested by plan and kept at detention centers, including Lubango. People were detained inside the camps, brought to interrogation, tortured, and abused until they signed a confession. They were fed minimally and many died of malnourishment or disease. Nearly 700 of these prisoners were never accounted for. I guess for SWAPO and PLAN here, they felt that cracking down on the spies was a way to maintain order and ensure that the struggle would be a success. All of this was collateral damage. Meanwhile, deteriorating conditions in Southwest Africa resulted in increases in the signs of public dissatisfaction with the apartheid regime. On 13 December 1971, more than 13,000 employees began a strike. The main reason for the strike was the unequal position of black workers in the labor market. The strike ended within a few weeks, but the promises made during the negotiations never came to fruition. And so in the 1970s and 1980s, several other strikes ensued. On the liberation front, SWAPO had a small victory for its movement. This was because on the 12th of December 1973, the organization was recognized by the United Nations as the only official representative of the people of Namibia. With the collapse of the Portuguese colonial rule in Angola, Nyoma negotiated the establishment of planned bases in southern Angola. This would make logistics way much easier for them. Newly independent Angola had a socialist government that was being supported by the Soviet Union and Cuba. Now that they had better supply lines, PLAN and SWAPO were able to launch a serious guerrilla warfare campaign.
We adopted guerrilla warfare tactics. Like Mao Zedong said, that when the enemy advances, you retreat. When the enemy retire, you attack. This is precisely what we did.
The South Africans retaliated by attacking the rebel bases across the border, including a strike into Zambia, which forced the Zambians to be more unwilling to support SWAPO. Thousands of young Namibians determined to take to arms crossed the border into Angola to join the ranks of SWAPO in exile. Sam Nyoma also stepped up the pressure with a more intense military campaign within Southwest Africa itself from 1978 through 1984. In turn, South Africa escalated the conflict toward a more conventional war, leading to a series of defeats for PLAN. One of the most horrific attacks occurred on the 4th of May 1978. This brutal attack by South Africa on PLAN was called the Battle of Kasinga or the Kasinga Massacre. In this operation, the South African Air Force flew over Kasinga, a Namibian refugee camp in southern Angola. The airborne troops bombed SWAPO's refugee camp and PLAN's military base. The bombing was followed by ground forces to complete the massacre. More than 600 Namibians, mostly women and children, were massacred by the South African Defense Forces airborne troops and hundreds more were injured. A United Nations delegation that visited Kasinga a few days after the tragic event reported that what the South Africans did was criminal in legal terms and savage in moral terms. One more thing I have to mention is that this struggle was occurring during the same time that the Angolan Civil War was taking place. It was also during the Cold War, and so several superpowers had vested interests in the political affairs of this region. Several countries became embroiled in this Angolan civil war and by extension, the battle for Namibian independence. In 1987, the war in Angola increased rapidly after South Africa gave support to UNITA, which was led by Jonas Savimbi. Here, the plan by South Africa was to destabilize Angola and its socialist government, in turn disrupting SWAPO and PLAN's military activities. The battle that was now taking place in Angola quickly developed into an arms duel between the South African and Cuban artillery. Cuban forces had come to Angola to support the ruling party, the MPLA, in their battle against UNITA. The fighting in southern Angola reached a climax in 1988, but ended with a stalemate in the town of Cuito Cunavale. Both sides involved in the war claimed victory in what was at the time described as the largest battle in Africa since the end of the Second World War. But after this intense battle, all sides seemed to have emerged keener for a settlement. Everyone was just tired at this point. Concurrently, there were other developments happening on the international stage from a diplomacy point of view. In the 1980s, political pressure was mounting on apartheid South Africa. For example, the United Nations formed a Western contact group of influential Western powers in order to put pressure on South Africa to grant Namibia independence. Also at the same time, the Soviet Union, who had been supporting the Angolan government, had also decided that it was time to withdraw its support. So now, with the Soviet Union scaling back its support for liberation movements around the globe, and with South Africa increasingly isolated, the Western Contact Group devised a plan calling for a ceasefire. This plan included a phased withdrawal of South African forces and one person, one vote elections in Namibia under the supervision of the United Nations. As I mentioned before, South Africa was becoming more isolated internationally and the cost of military intervention was increasing. So the South African government realized that if they got out of Namibia at that point, they could set some terms for Namibia's independence and protect South African business interests in the territory. A comprehensive peace agreement was finally reached in 1988. Ending 3 decades in exile, Sam Nujoma returned to Namibia in September of 1989 to enter the political struggle for the future of his country, Namibia. During his long years in exile, when he was dependent on communist support, Nujoma often called for a socialist government for Namibia. Although he continued to insist that the new government would undertake land reform and redistribute wealth to the black majority, during the election campaign, he went out of his way to reassure the white population in Namibia that their rights would be protected and that he would not impose one-party rule. SWAPO won just over 57% of the total vote, ensuring that Nujoma would be chosen by the Constituent Assembly to lead Namibia into independence. And so on 21 March 1990, Namibia became independent, with guests such as the then South African President F.W. de Klerk and USA and Russian foreign ministers.
I move in the name of our people to declare that Namibia is forever free, sovereign and independent. I thank you.
Upon assuming the presidency of independent Namibia, Sam Nujoma proclaimed national reconciliation and nation building as his priorities. In 1994, he was re-elected president, and in 1998, the SWAPO-controlled parliament agreed to amend the constitution, allowing Nujoma to run for a third term. The move drew international and domestic criticism, but Nujoma easily won re-election in 1999. He later announced that he would not run for a fourth term, and in 2005, he stepped down from office, allowing for a peaceful transfer of power to his democratically elected successor, Hifikepunye Pohamba, also from SWAPO. Sam Nujoma stepped down from his position as president of SWAPO in 2007. Sam Nujoma is considered as being one of the fathers of the African independence struggle. Let me know in the comment section below what your thoughts are regarding Sam Nujoma and Namibia's struggle for independence from apartheid South Africa. Don't forget to like and share the video if you enjoyed it. Thank you all for tuning in. This has been Tatenda for African Biographics. Until next time, cheers. Have a good one. Africa, I'm on. See that
Africa, Amman. See that kid at Kayankao. Africa, Amman. Hey, see that kid at Kayankao. Africa, see that kid at Kayankao. See that kid at Kayankao. Africa, Amman. See that kid at Kayankao. Africa, Amman. Kaunda mama. Nyerere. Mondlane Mashella Mugabe Mama Mgomoye Serete Africa Sida Kira Kayankao Africa Ama. It's a Namibian song and it simply means we are very glad that we are fighting for the total liberation of Africa as well as Namibia. At the same time, the song praises all the African leaders, especially those involved in the struggle south of the Zambezi. On the other side, the song praises all our fellow freedom fighters, compatriots and comrades. Some of them have sacrificed their lives for the total liberation of their motherland. Some of them are imprisoned by the fascist South African regime on Robben Island. See the kid of Kayanko, Africa, Amman. See the kid of Kayanko, Africa, Amman. See the kid of Kayanko, Africa, Amman. Lutuli mama, Mandela. Tiro, tiro, yeah. Sobukwe. Toivo mama, yeah, toivo. Toivo. Kahumba, Duateleni, Mahuiriri, Meroro Mama, Betty Boye, Kutako, Madume, Maharero, Ekanjo, Shindika Mama, Yeta Popi, Shikongo, Mushimba, Nuyama mama, Nuyama. Sida kira kanyanka, Africa Amman. Sida kira kanyanka, Africa Amman. Sida kira kanyanka, Africa sida kira kanyanka. Agostino Neto, Lumumba. Go wapi, Caprala. Caprala mama, Seguture, Siad Bare, Sadata, Gaddafi, Nguruma, Achabong mama, Yawara, Bomedi, Bomedina, Sida Gera Kayanka, Africa Amman, Sida Gera Kayanka, Africa Amman. Africa mama, yeah, yeah. Africa, yeah, yeah. Africa mama, yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, yeah.
There's a lot going on in the world today. See how it affects Montreal's Black and Caribbean community. Read the community contact. News, features, opinions, music reviews, cultural events, and so much more. Our voices, our perspectives, our community. Published every 2 weeks, pick it up at your favorite community spot or visit us online at our new and dynamic website, mtlcommunitycontact.com. Easy to navigate and lots to enjoy. Archived issues also on the site and available on the web. That's mtlcommunitycontact.com. Stay in contact.
So that just about wraps it up here for us, folks. Thank you so much for tuning in. As Doug and I have mentioned previously, we're in the midst of restructuring the show. So over the next month or so, you will likely mostly be hearing the Best of Amandla rebroadcasts as we try to come up with a new way of producing the show. We've been on the air for something like 3 decades and would like to continue to be on the air, but we feel like it's time to kind of switch things up on the show. So we're looking forward to hopefully sometime in September presenting a new format of Amanla to you. And as I said, in the meantime, you'll be hearing pieces from times past, but ones that we think and hope you'll enjoy. So stay tuned now for Jazz Euphorium.
If your last vaccination against COVID-19 was more than 5 months ago, it's time to get another dose. Boosting your antibodies reduces the risk of getting or transmitting the virus, and booster doses help reduce the number of hospitalizations and deaths related to COVID-19. For better protection against the virus, book an appointment at quebec.ca/COVID-vaccine and follow the recommended vaccination schedule. Vaccination against COVID-19, a good way of extending our protection. A message from the Gouvernement du Québec.
The words mental illness, what do you think?
I have friends who don't even know that I suffer from depression.
Why don't they know?
Because I'm scared they'll ostracize me if they know and then they'll abandon me. I don't want to be alone.
You're discriminated against when you have a mental illness. With other illnesses, there's compassion.
It doesn't take much to be diagnosed mentally ill.
Due to an outburst, I was diagnosed paranoid schizophrenic. And now the doctors say it's something else.
20% of people and counting have had or will have a depression.
People throw different labels around. You're this or you're that.
Everybody psychoanalyzes someone during a conversation.
You have a right to express emotions.
Anger, love, hate, sadness, confusion. It does not mean you're ill.
If you're down and out, seek help. Don't be scared. It can be very intimidating.
There are people listening and willing to help.
We have to innovate.
Get informed.